Listening test. Task 1. You are going to listen to a recording on the phenomenon of voluntourism, which combines travel and volunteer work. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for each question, 1 to 7. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
It comes after charities campaign for governments everywhere to start recognising the problems of voluntourism, where tourists do volunteer work in the community where they're taking a holiday. There's a whole industry that's grown up around voluntourism, with Western voluntourist operators charging people for package holidays that include volunteering opportunities in the developing world. Some estimates put the global industry's worth at some $2 billion a year, and many of the projects they do involve helping out in orphanages. Pippa Biddle is an American and a former voluntourist herself. She volunteered to help build a library for an orphanage in Tanzania back in 2014, a year before she graduated from high school back in the United States. It was a transformative experience, but not in the way originally intended.
I am an early riser. I was also running cross country at the time and was trying to get myself to practice by waking up early and running laps alongside the inner side of the wall of the compound we were staying in. And it was before anyone else in our group was awake. And I was running and I saw that the men were already at the work site, and they had a habit, we believed, of always showing up late. They were never there on time. And I'd say that our general understanding of them was that they didn't really care. And it was very sort of shocking to find out that the reason they were late was because they'd actually already been there for hours and then needed a break, because they had to redo what we'd done the day before in such a way that, one, we did not see them, and two, it was set in time that when we did show up to work, it would be ready for us to keep going.
So local tradesmen were dismantling and rebuilding what Pippa's group of volunteers had spent the previous day constructing, all to keep up a pretense that what Pippa's group was doing was useful.
It was a very shocking realization. And I'd say that at the time, I really didn't want to accept it. I spoke about it with just a very small number of people who by and large encouraged me to keep it to myself, because it was not something that would positively reflect on our experience. I was just upset, and I really did not want to accept it, especially because I actually had more programs that summer that I'd be taking part in that classify as voluntourism. So I did not want to see what I was seeing or to believe that that was representative. And so I really sort of housed it in my brain, said, this is this one experience. This is not representative of voluntourism. Let's move on. And what I realized over the years was that my experience was actually far more representative of voluntourism than I would have liked it to have been.
Did you ever take it up with the organizers afterwards?
Well, so our trip was organized through what I'd call a trip provider. So there's nonprofit ones, there's for-profit ones. I did not have contact with the trip provider because the trip provider was liaising with my school. I did bring it up with my school, and I respect the school that I went to very much. I appreciate what they've done to sort of do programming better over the years. I think that at the time, they were not quite ready to address it as a problem, because their focus was on our education and what we were getting for the trip, and really not wholly on what was being provided to the community.
That is the point, isn't it? This trip, in the end, was all about you and your classmates, the girls you travelled with. And that incident showed that it had very little to do with the community that you thought you were helping.
Absolutely. I think that's actually at the very core of the issues with voluntourism, is that any time we're measuring the benefit of something by how the most powerful people in an exchange benefit from it, that's not the right equation to be following. The issues with voluntourism go so far beyond an ineffectual building project. I find it to be really important to differentiate between voluntourism and skilled aid work. So Doctors Without Borders, very different.
It comes after charities campaign for governments everywhere to start recognising the problems of voluntourism, where tourists do volunteer work in the community where they're taking a holiday. There's a whole industry that's grown up around voluntourism, with Western voluntourist operators charging people for package holidays that include volunteering opportunities in the developing world. Some estimates put the global industry's worth at some $2 billion a year, and many of the projects they do involve helping out in orphanages. Pippa Biddle is an American and a former voluntourist herself. She volunteered to help build a library for an orphanage in Tanzania back in 2014, a year before she graduated from high school back in the United States. It was a transformative experience, but not in the way originally intended.
I am an early riser. I was also running cross country at the time and was trying to get myself to practice by waking up early and running laps alongside the inner side of the wall of the compound we were staying in. And it was before anyone else in our group was awake. And I was running and I saw that the men were already at the work site, and they had a habit, we believed, of always showing up late. They were never there on time. And I'd say that our general understanding of them was that they didn't really care. And it was very sort of shocking to find out that the reason they were late was because they'd actually already been there for hours and then needed a break, because they had to redo what we'd done the day before in such a way that, one, we did not see them, and two, it was set in time that when we did show up to work, it would be ready for us to keep going.
So local tradesmen were dismantling and rebuilding what Pippa's group of volunteers had spent the previous day constructing, all to keep up a pretense that what Pippa's group was doing was useful.
It was a very shocking realization. And I'd say that at the time, I really didn't want to accept it. I spoke about it with just a very small number of people who by and large encouraged me to keep it to myself, because it was not something that would positively reflect on our experience. I was just upset, and I really did not want to accept it, especially because I actually had more programs that summer that I'd be taking part in that classify as voluntourism. So I did not want to see what I was seeing or to believe that that was representative. And so I really sort of housed it in my brain, said, this is this one experience. This is not representative of voluntourism. Let's move on. And what I realized over the years was that my experience was actually far more representative of voluntourism than I would have liked it to have been.
Did you ever take it up with the organizers afterwards?
Well, so our trip was organized through what I'd call a trip provider. So there's nonprofit ones, there's for-profit ones. I did not have contact with the trip provider because the trip provider was liaising with my school. I did bring it up with my school, and I respect the school that I went to very much. I appreciate what they've done to sort of do programming better over the years. I think that at the time, they were not quite ready to address it as a problem, because their focus was on our education and what we were getting for the trip, and really not wholly on what was being provided to the community.
That is the point, isn't it? This trip, in the end, was all about you and your classmates, the girls you travelled with. And that incident showed that it had very little to do with the community that you thought you were helping.
Absolutely. I think that's actually at the very core of the issues with voluntourism, is that any time we're measuring the benefit of something by how the most powerful people in an exchange benefit from it, that's not the right equation to be following. The issues with voluntourism go so far beyond an ineffectual building project. I find it to be really important to differentiate between voluntourism and skilled aid work. So Doctors Without Borders, very different.
Task 2. You are going to listen to a recording with Lynn Hill about a spectacular climb. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, answer the questions 1 to 9 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
El Capitan is one of the toughest rock climbs in the world. 3,000 feet high, a kilometer of rock rising sheer from the floor of the Yosemite Valley, 200 miles southeast of San Francisco.
Well, Yosemite is world famous. It's one of the wonders of the world. It's just a magnificent place. For the length of the valley, you see gigantic walls of granite. And El Capitan is the largest. You just can't even get your mind around it.
One false step on this mountain spells death. Yet men do climb it, seemingly without fear.
As this BBC archive from 1980 describes, men had been climbing El Capitan since 1958. The first ascent had been completed by Warren Harding and his team.
And they had a much different approach than us because, first of all, they didn't have the same gear. And it had never been done. It was an expedition like going to the moon because nobody could really rescue them. If they were in the middle of a 3,000-foot wall, who was going to be able to get to them? Not even a helicopter would be able to get to you.
Their feat had been truly historic, but they'd hammered bolts into the blank face of the rock and used ropes to support their weight as they scaled hundreds of metres of sheer cliff. Over the years, others followed. But no one imagined it could be done without aid. In other words, free climbing. Much less that it could be done by a woman.
As a young girl, I was probably 14 or 15, and I was doing a hard move on this boulder, and I heard a man behind me say, "Gee, I can't even do that." And I kind of turned around and looked at him and thought, "Well, why would you think you could?" And I heard stuff like that all the time. People didn't expect a girl to be able to do the hardest climbs of the day.
She wasn't deterred, and her career spanned nearly 20 years before she decided to bow out of the sport with one final big gesture.
That was my retirement gesture, to take all of my skills and to try to do something that had never been done before on the most famous big wall climb in the world. So that was my way of saying, okay, here is a demonstration of what a woman can do.
So in the late summer of 1993, Lynn Hill and fellow climber Simon Naden set off to climb the nose, the hardest route up El Capitan. And they were going to try to free climb it using minimal equipment, nothing to help haul themselves up, just ropes and carabiners to secure themselves to the rock to prevent them falling too far.
Well, when I first started climbing, the first rule of climbing was sort of a joke, don't fall. So we tried not to fall.
Lynn and Simon would take it in turns to lead while the other belayed or held on to the rope that would catch the leader if they fell. They relied on their climbing instincts to figure out how to scale the almost blank face, jamming their fingers into the tiniest of cracks and using their bodies in a series of Spider-Man-like moves.
We tried to master our movements so that we didn't fall. Sometimes you'd climb up, you'd see a very difficult move, and you'd down climb back to a rest, you'd shake out, and you'd think about it, you'd go back up, and you'd look again, and maybe touch the hold and say, I think I can do it, and go back down, rest again, and then decide, okay, this time when I get back up there, I'm going to grab that hold and I'm going to just keep going. So there was a lot of psychological skills involved.
On the first day, they managed 500 feet of the vertical climb. That night, they slept on a ledge.
Oh, it's awesome. It's beautiful. When you're on El Cap, the wall is behind you, but you have the full screen of the sky. You can also look down and see the cars driving by in the valley. And of course, you're tied in. You don't ever take your harness off. You give yourself a little bit of room so that you can roll around in your sleeping bag, but not so much that you'll roll off the ledge. And so you know that you're in security and you're not going to die in the night.
El Capitan is one of the toughest rock climbs in the world. 3,000 feet high, a kilometer of rock rising sheer from the floor of the Yosemite Valley, 200 miles southeast of San Francisco.
Well, Yosemite is world famous. It's one of the wonders of the world. It's just a magnificent place. For the length of the valley, you see gigantic walls of granite. And El Capitan is the largest. You just can't even get your mind around it.
One full step on this mountain spells death. Yet men do climb it, seemingly without fear.
As this BBC archive from 1980 describes, men had been climbing El Capitan since 1958. The first ascent had been completed by Warren Harding and his team.
And they had a much different approach than us because, first of all, they didn't have the same gear. And it had never been done. It was an expedition like going to the moon because nobody could really rescue them. If they were in the middle of a 3,000-foot wall, who was going to be able to get to them? Not even a helicopter would be able to get to you.
Their feat had been truly historic, but they'd hammered bolts into the blank face of the rock and used ropes to support their weight as they scaled hundreds of meters of sheer cliff. Over the years, others followed. But no one imagined it could be done without aid. In other words, free climbing. Much less that it could be done by a woman.
As a young girl, I was probably 14 or 15, and I was doing a hard move on this boulder, and I heard a man behind me say, "Gee, I can't even do that." And I kind of turned around and looked at him and thought, "Well, why would you think you could?" And I heard stuff like that all the time. People didn't expect a girl to be able to do the hardest climbs of the day.
She wasn't deterred, and her career spanned nearly 20 years before she decided to bow out of the sport with one final big gesture.
That was my retirement gesture, to take all of my skills and to try to do something that had never been done before on the most famous big wall climb in the world. So that was my way of saying, okay, here is a demonstration of what a woman can do.
So in the late summer of 1993, Lynn Hill and fellow climber Simon Naden set off to climb the nose, the hardest route up El Capitan. And they were going to try to free climb it using minimal equipment, nothing to help haul themselves up, just ropes and carabiners to secure themselves to the rock to prevent them falling too far.
Well, when I first started climbing, the first rule of climbing was sort of a joke, don't fall. So we tried not to fall.
Lynn and Simon would take it in turns to lead while the other belayed or held on to the rope that would catch the leader if they fell. They relied on their climbing instincts to figure out how to scale the almost blank face, jamming their fingers into the tiniest of cracks and using their bodies in a series of Spider-Man-like moves.
We tried to master our movements so that we didn't fall. Sometimes you'd climb up, you'd see a very difficult move, and you'd down climb back to a rest, you'd shake out and you'd think about it, you'd go back up and you'd look again and maybe touch the hold and say, I think I can do it, and go back down, rest again, and then decide, okay, this time when I get back up there, I'm going to grab that hold and I'm going to just keep going. So there was a lot of psychological skills involved.
On the first day, they managed 500 feet of the vertical climb. That night, they slept on a ledge.
Oh, it's awesome. It's beautiful. When you're on El Cap, the wall is behind you, but you have the full screen of the sky. You can also look down and see the cars driving by in the valley. And, of course, you're tied in. You don't ever take your harness off. You give yourself a little bit of room so that you can roll around in your sleeping bag, but not so much that you'll roll off the ledge. And so you know that you're in security and you're not going to die in the night.
Task 3. You are going to listen to a conversation about a dog. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences 1 to 8 with the sentence endings A to K. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
You join me here at London's Kennel Club Dog Library, where there are thousands of fascinating dog-related books, including some dating back to the medieval period. Many are very informative, but others are rather less than scientific. Kira Farrell, the librarian here, has been telling me about one particular 17th century dog who got accused of witchcraft.
Ah, yes, Boy. Boy is a very interesting dog. Boy is the oldest book we have in the collection about a named dog, a specific one. This is a dog who's a character, he's an individual. 1642 is when this book dates from.
Wow.
Which was in the middle of the English Civil War. Boy belonged to a handsome young man called Prince Rupert of Bohemia. He was born in the modern-day Czech Republic. He was a nephew of King Charles I of England. When he was about 17, his uncle arranged for him to have the poodle. Poodle means pond. Means water, means a dog that swims. They're duck hunting dogs. So he came back to London with his beautiful poodle. No one had ever seen one in London before. It was a sensation. Everybody knew this dog. So when the Civil War broke out, he's on the king's side, obviously. He's the king's nephew. On the other side, the parliamentarians who are looking for parliamentary democracy, some of them are extremely religious and they're very frightened of witchcraft. So this book attempts to slander Prince Rupert by accusing him and his dog of witchcraft.
Wow.
So it says the dog has the gift of prophecy. He can tell the future. He has the art of finding out concealed goods. He will find your buried treasure for you. He's got the gift of languages. He can speak. He is weaponproof and has made his master weaponproof. And finally, he can go invisible. And then it goes on about how he's involved in Satan and he curses the church and all this sort of stuff. It says he's not a dog. He's a witch, a sorceress, enemy to Parliament, a malignant cavalier dog with something of the devil in or about him. So that's fairly outrageous stuff, isn't it? You can't accuse Prince Rupert of witchcraft. This is probably a joke, this pamphlet. It probably wasn't written by the Puritans or by anybody who truly believed in witchcraft. It was probably written by Prince Rupert and some of his friends to take the mickey a little bit, to tease the religious Puritans, to point out their religious hysteria. But it is interesting that Boy was so well known, you could do a pamphlet like this to give out in the street or sell to people about Boy, and everybody would know who Boy was. If you look at this woodcut, it depicts the Battle of Marston Moor, which was one of the major, major engagements of the Civil War. And here in the corner, very crudely drawn, we can see Boy.
Aww.
With his legs up in the air, dead. Aww. Prince Rupert was captured at this engagement. Maybe he was captured because he was distracted by his dog being killed. He didn't stay captured for long. Prince Rupert led a very long and interesting life. But we really only care about his dog. So we have Boy for 7 years. Boy was about seven when he died. So Boy is the oldest dog in the collection that we know everything about. Name, date of birth, colour, breed, who owns him, and exactly when he died.
And he's where the term comes from, who's a good boy? You join me here at London's Kennel Club Dog Library, where there are thousands of fascinating dog-related books, including some dating back to the medieval period. Many are very informative, but others are rather less than scientific. Kira Farrell, the librarian here, has been telling me about one particular 17th century dog who got accused of witchcraft.
Ah, yes, Boy. Boy's a very interesting dog. Boy is the oldest book we have in the collection about a named dog, a specific one. This is a dog who's a character. He's an individual. 1642 is when this book dates from.
Wow.
Which was in the middle of the English Civil War. Boy belonged to a handsome young man called Prince Rupert of Bohemia. He was born in the modern-day Czech Republic. He was a nephew of King Charles I of England. When he was about 17, his uncle arranged for him to have the poodle. Poodle means pond. Means water, means a dog that swims. They're duck hunting dogs. So he came back to London with his beautiful poodle. No one had ever seen one in London before. It was a sensation. Everybody knew this dog. So when the Civil War broke out, he's on the king's side, obviously. He's the king's nephew. On the other side, the parliamentarians who are looking for parliamentary democracy, some of them are extremely religious and they're very frightened of witchcraft. So this book attempts to slander Prince Rupert by accusing him and his dog of witchcraft.
Wow.
So it says the dog has the gift of prophecy. He can tell the future. He has the art of finding out concealed goods. He will find your buried treasure for you. He's got the gift of languages. He can speak. He is weaponproof and has made his master weaponproof. And finally, he can go invisible. And then it goes on about how he's involved in Satan and he curses the church and all this sort of stuff. It says he's not a dog. He's a witch, a sorceress, enemy to Parliament, a malignant cavalier dog with something of the devil in or about him. So that's fairly outrageous stuff, isn't it? You can't accuse Prince Rupert of witchcraft. This is probably a joke, this pamphlet. It probably wasn't written by the Puritans or by anybody who truly believed in witchcraft. It was probably written by Prince Rupert and some of his friends to take the mickey a little bit, to tease the religious Puritans, to point out their religious hysteria. But it is interesting that Boy was so well known, you could do a pamphlet like this to give out in the street or sell to people about Boy and everybody would know who Boy was. If you look at this woodcut, it depicts the Battle of Marston Moor, which was one of the major, major engagements of the Civil War. And here in the corner, very crudely drawn, we can see Boy.
Aww.
With his legs up in the air, dead. Prince Rupert was captured at this engagement. Maybe he was captured because he was distracted by his dog being killed. He didn't stay captured for long. Prince Rupert led a very long and interesting life. But we really only care about his dog. So we have Boy for 7 years. Boy was about seven when he died. So Boy is the oldest dog in the collection that we know everything about. Name, date of birth, colour, breed, who owns him, and exactly when he died.
And he's where the term comes from, who's a good boy?
Task 4. You are going to listen to recommendations for detective series on Netflix. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, Match the titles of the series with the statements A to J. There are two extra statements that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
It's very easy to get hooked on crime series when you're watching Netflix because the next episode keeps coming up. Broadchurch was one that I found very compelling. It's set in an idyllic village on the coast of England, beautiful scenery, and the crime is committed on a beach. It's obvious from the start that the crime has been committed by somebody in the village. But it's not clear to the very last moment exactly who it is. I'm also very fond of one series that I really enjoyed on Netflix was Dr. Foster. I found that we really couldn't stop watching it. It was very compelling. At the centre, there's Gemma Foster, who is a doctor, and she finds out that somebody close to her is, or she suspects that somebody close to her is betraying her. And at first she's confused, but then she realises it's her suspicions are confirmed, and she sets out to take her revenge. Another really compelling series was The Fall, which is set in Belfast, where a detective, who herself is a very interesting character, is brought across from England to track down a cold-blooded criminal. And she herself, she is so interesting because she is very unemotional and detached kind of character. But eventually the lives of the criminal and the detective start to influence each other and they have an impact on each other. The Bridge is a great series. Again, it's extremely well produced. The detective is a female, again, and she has some issues of her own. She finds it very difficult to communicate with people, but she's very committed to solving the crime, very conscientious about it. And the criminal targets people who he thinks are guilty of something. He has a grudge against society, and he illustrates his five truths about society in the murders that he commits and communicates them to the police in this way. Another great series is Paranoid, which starts off with a crime being committed on a children's playground, actually witnessed by several people, but nevertheless it seems to be difficult to track down the criminal. This one's interesting because it's set not only in England, but in Germany, and this comes up a lot nowadays in these crime series, that the setting is split between two European locations. Fargo was recommended to me by an American friend. It's a series based on a 90s film, and it's more thriller than crime, really. It's got lots of black humour in it. I really enjoyed the first series on account of the bad guy, Malvo, who is, I suppose you could say, the ultimate clever criminal, completely without scruples, and also Lester, the victim, who gets involved with Malvo through a chance meeting, is a very interesting character. It's very easy to get hooked on crime series when you're watching Netflix
because the next episode keeps coming up. Broadchurch was one that I found very compelling. It's set in an idyllic village on the coast of England, beautiful scenery, and the crime is committed on a beach. It's obvious from the start that the crime has been committed by somebody in the village, but it's not clear to the very last moment exactly who it is. I'm also very fond of... One series that I really enjoyed on Netflix was Dr. Foster. I found that we really couldn't stop watching it. It was very compelling. At the centre, there's Gemma Foster, who is a doctor, and she finds out that somebody close to her is, or she suspects that somebody close to her is betraying her. And at first she's confused, but then she realises it's her suspicions are confirmed, and she sets out to take her revenge. Another really compelling series was The Fall, which is set in Belfast, with a detective who herself is a very interesting character is brought across from England to track down a cold-blooded criminal. And she herself, she is so interesting because she is very unemotional and detached kind of character. But eventually the lives of the criminal and the detective start to influence each other, and they have an impact on each other. The Bridge is a great series. Again, it's extremely well produced. The detective is a female, again, and she has some issues of her own. She finds it very difficult to communicate with people, but she's very committed to solving the crime, very conscientious about it. And the criminal targets people who he thinks are guilty of something. He has a grudge against society, and he illustrates his five truths about society in the murders that he commits and communicates them to the police in this way. Another great series is Paranoid, which starts off with a crime being committed on a children's playground, actually witnessed by several people, but nevertheless it seems to be difficult to track down the criminal. This one's interesting because it's set not only in England but in Germany, and this comes up a lot nowadays in these crime series, that the setting is split between two European locations. Fargo was recommended to me by an American friend. It's a series based on a 90s film, and it's more thriller than crime, really. It's got lots of black humour in it. I really enjoyed the first series on account of the bad guy, Malvo, who is, I suppose you could say, the ultimate clever criminal, completely without scruples, and also Lester, the victim, who gets involved with Malvo through a chance meeting, is a very interesting character.
This is the end of the listening test.